This is Trepwire Week in Review for week ending April 16th. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLO markets. I'm with Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Joe McBride, Head of CRE Finance. This week, despite the pause of J&J's one-shot option, U.S. average daily vaccinations exceeded 3.3 million. And economic news points to a recovery that has picked up speed. Retail sales surged nearly 10% last month, with the restaurant industry seeing a healthy upswing. And more positive news as weekly jobless claims dropped to a one-year low. And the government reported that industrial production rebounded last month. All this news sent the markets on a tear, hitting new highs. Manus, even the Fed's economic survey released this week shows that the recovery is a broad-based effort across multiple industries.
It really did feel like an inflection week, didn't it? With extraordinarily strong data coming out. I think people were expecting good data to come out in retail sales and in other areas after the big stimulus checks went out last month. But I think people were really blown away by the extent of the beats, if you will, the beating of expectations. Let's start with the retail sales number, 9.8% growth in March. That compared to expectations of about 5.7%, just an extraordinarily strong number. A quick tip of the week for those that want to get ahead of this number, Zero Hedge does a really good job of tracking this. They report on Bank of America's model, which tracks their credit card spending each month. And for three consecutive months, B of A has now been really spot on. They predicted a great beat in January, helped by the stimulus package at the end of 2020. That came through. They were very close on that number. They expected a disappointment in February because there was no stimulus. And of course, we had the terrible weather in big parts of the country. And they were predicting a 10% jump this month. And as I said, Zero Hedge does a nice job keeping up with this stuff. So if this is a number that's important to you as somebody that follows retail, or if you think that retail is a driver of stock market moves, it's a great piece to look out for every single month. And it's a good piece of data to follow. The amazing thing about the retail sales number today is that normally you would think that this would come with a hefty spike in interest rates. And we didn't get that today at all. Interest rates hovered near their 30-day low in the 1.63% range for the 10-year treasury. So even though the retail number was great, it didn't trigger an uptick in yields. The same can be true. Earlier this week, we saw a tame CPI, which wouldn't have triggered an uptick in rates. And we saw a pretty hot PPI number earlier in the week, which had the potential to drive up rates, but in neither case did it have a material impact. The other big data point today, Thursday, which is the day we're recording this, Thursday, April 15th, the old tax day. Initial jobless claims, 125,000 below consensus estimates. People were expecting 700,000 new claims, which would have been a post-COVID low, if I'm not mistaken. And the actual number came in 576,000 initial jobless claims. So terrific economic data this week. Stocks went up, but they didn't melt up. So it felt like an inflection point that with rates hovering where they are, economic data ticking up, and the stock market moving up kind of in an orderly way, it felt like the best of all worlds.
Well, we also had Powell on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, right before the inflation numbers came out, saying, even if inflation goes above 2%, we're going to let it stay there for a while because we want inflation to average 2% over the longer term. Not anything new coming out of his mouth there, but it was just kind of another reiteration of that stance from the Fed. On the COVID front, this is actually data from a couple of days ago, so it's probably even more now. 36% of the population, at least one dose of the COVID vaccine, and about 22, 23% fully vaccinated. Those numbers have probably ticked up over the last 4 or 5 days. So, you know, that's kind of the fundamentals behind people, that plus stimulus, right? Fundamentals behind the reopening.
So when you think about that, Martha's number when at the top was, I think, 3.3 million per day. When you multiply that over the course of a 30-day month, you're talking about 100 million shots a month, two shots per person. That means 50 million people are getting covered every single month, which is about 1/6 of the US population. Probably even more when you consider that people are not getting their children vaccinated, right? People under 10 or maybe even under 18 are rarely getting vaccinated. So, you know, within 2 months, we're going to have another 100 million people vaccinated, assuming people continue to embrace the vaccination process. And that means herd immunity is here probably by mid-June. And that's a wonderful thing. And then you see the airlines coming back and the cruise ships and the ball games start getting, you know, 30,000 people instead of 8,000 people. So it really, as I said, it felt like an inflection this month that as long as the economy doesn't overheat, right, which is a true concern, that is the potential for this to be meaningful. And as long as the Fed handles its tapering and signals it in such a way that it is gradual, we could probably get by pretty well. I still think the biggest risk for fixed income investors right now is the Fed coming out and saying bond purchases are done, or bond purchases are going to go down by 50% for the next 2 months or something like that. That's the case where spreads blow out and all of a sudden you have enormous fixed income volatility, right? But if they manage that and inflation becomes measured increases, not racing upward, then I think we could see sustained growth, you know, for the next year or two.
Yeah, one number that we didn't say before in the retail numbers, when they break it out, right, by different sectors. And restaurants and bars were up 13.4% month over month. They're up 36% from March 2020. And if you remember, I mean, March 2020 was kind of like a half of a month. That's when right about in the middle of the month was when everything kind of shut down. So up 36% from a half good month, you know, that's really great. So I can't wait to see what they look like next month.
One thing we didn't even throw in this week, and I know we're going to get into this in much greater detail, the tailwind that also helped the market this week was really solid earnings, right? Yeah. Most of what got released this week were bank earnings. And I know Joe will get into that a little bit more, but I will pull out two things that came out of JPM this week. You know, one is consumer spending is back, right? A really bullish remark. And the expectation, kind of consistent with what I said a few moments ago, you know, we're looking at potentially robust multi-year growth, right? You know, assuming that we handle this correctly. And that's great. I think that's great for American workers. It's great for people and their 401k. It's great for employees that were left on the sidewalk when COVID hit us.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the concerns coming out of this, and something that could spark a little bit of that inflation even more, is actually getting workers back, right? And there's been, I think we'll probably touch on a couple of them later, but there are stories out there of, you know, restaurants and Uber and other companies that just are having trouble getting back up to speed with workers, especially workers who maybe have done pretty well on the stimulus and on unemployment.
Yeah, I mean, the generosity of the unemployment insurance is, you know, I think there's been articles about this saying that people would rather get $300 a week to stay home than $400 or $500 a week to work. And, you know, maybe that makes sense if you consider commuting costs and finding daycare for your kids and other things. You know, that's probably a rational economic choice, especially if your kids are not going back to school. So that has to have some impact on the labor market, and that may continue for a while.
So as Manus mentioned, first quarter earnings season kicked off this week with several of the big banks reporting results that in many cases blew away estimates, especially as the banks released some of their rainy day money. Joe, why don't you walk us through the details of what that looked like?
Yep. Okay. So settle in. Going to throw a lot of numbers at you. The general theme is that for most of these guys, these are the big banks, you know, not too surprising, trading and investment bank fees were up just astronomically. Interesting that trading at Citi was actually flat, but at JP Morgan, they were up 25%. At Goldman, they were up 47%, which included 68% in their equity trading group. It's just kind of just off the charts. You know, some of the stuff about underwriting new SPAC deals and advising on those, you know, the special purpose acquisition companies, was a big, big driver of the increase in these fees.
The interesting thing for me is how little these firms were rewarded in their stock prices after some of these beats. you know, we saw with Goldman, they beat on the bottom line by 50%. People were expecting $12 a share in earnings this quarter. They got 18% and their stock went up, you know, a couple bucks after the fact, which tells me that, you know, success is phenomenally priced in at this point, which is one of those things that we always worry about is the market and the equity side and things like crypto and other things just too frothy. And here, how do you beat by 50% on the bottom line and have just that narrow run up in price that we saw on Wednesday?
So funny you say that. I looked at all of these and these are year-to-date stock price returns, including the effect of, you know, whatever happened today, because I just pulled these today. But every chart you looked at, the return had already occurred, right, before earnings. So JP Morgan was up 21%, Bank of America was up 29%, Goldman up 28%, Citi 20%, Wells Fargo 42% all year to date. On average, that's like a 28% price return going into the first quarter. So I think what that bump that you're talking about had already occurred.
You know? So the whisper numbers on that Goldman number must have been 16 or 17 bucks, right? The formal estimates average $12 a share. To come in at 18 means people are expecting a robust beat even before that. I'll throw in one more comment from the JP Morgan. It was the only real sign of any indication that there could be bumps in the road going forward. And that is that loan creation, loan demand going forward could be weak. And that makes sense, right? We had historically low interest rates. Anybody who could have locked in probably did, has refinanced either at a corporate level or a personal level on the residential side. And we could see loan demand tapering off at this point. You know, the 30-year mortgage right now is 75 basis points higher, I think, than it had been at its trough.
Trust me, I know that. Yeah, so the balance, the outstanding balances on loans at Wells Fargo down 15%. At Bank of America down 14%. I don't think I have the number for JP Morgan, but I think it was in the kind of 10 to 15% drop area. A couple other numbers here. So these are all quarterly year over year increases. So JP Morgan revenue was up 14%. Bank of America was actually flat from a revenue perspective, but their earnings were doubled. A lot of this has to do with releasing loan loss reserves. We talked a lot about CECL stuff over the last year. Now coming out of this, a lot of the banks are starting to have some rosier pictures or rosier outlook on the macro side. So that leads to them lowering their expected loss reserves. Goldman revenue up 100% year over year on the quarter at $17.7 billion. Their earnings were almost 5X'd essentially. Citi, a couple interesting news, not really relevant for us real estate wise, but you know, Citi's always the interesting one. They always got something going on. So they are shuttering their consumer banking divisions in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. They're going to continue to focus on wealth management over there, but seems like they're kind of battening down the hatches a little bit with that. Their revenue was down 7%, although it did beat expectations. Their earnings were up to almost $8 billion, up from $2.5 billion last year. So I'm throwing a lot of numbers at you, but of the Wells, Citi, Bank of America, and JP Morgan, they released in total $12.9 billion in loan loss reserves. So that's just capital that is now ready to be allocated. And it's just, it's an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the amount of capital out in the market right now.
If I'm not mistaken, I think JP Morgan's reserves are now back to where they were a year ago, right? Pre-pandemic, which means that, you know, they loaded up on reserves thinking the worst was going to happen. And now they've completely flushed out the excess reserves that they put aside that came with the COVID-19. But I'll close with one thought about those Goldman numbers and some of those other numbers you referred to. For those overworked analysts at these banks, there might be another fruit basket on your way.
Well, Goldman, they did have one line in there that the investment banking pipeline is still at an all-time high, but David Solomon, the CEO, I think is trying to temper expectations a little bit after such an amazing blowout quarter. He came out and said, don't expect another quarter like this, even though, you know, we expect to stay strong, but just don't expect it to be this crazy.
Well, if these SPACs really taper off, right? If you see a downturn in that, that may weigh on their earnings going forward. It's hard to imagine them keeping up that pace, considering how amazing the pace has been, number one. And number two is it seems like the whole segment is coming under greater scrutiny at this point. So we'll see.
I wonder if we could sell the podcast. We can sell the podcast to a SPAC.
What I want to sell is one of those non-fungible tokens.
I was going to say that.
Like the first 15 seconds of our first podcast. In fact, if anybody wants to reach out to us, if you're interested in that, you know, we'll go, you know, let's say the first bid over 2.5 million, right? Didn't Jack get that money for his first tweet?
Yes.
I like the guy that did the skateboarding with his Ocean Spray to Dreams. I think that went for an astronaut.
That guy did that viral video. Oh my God.
Yes, I don't get it.
Because I can still watch that video. I don't have to pay anybody to watch that video. So
and if you're on a budget, you know, if you want the second 15 seconds, you know, we'll offer that at a sizable discount. But the first 15 seconds, we do want a premium price.
Now, turning to office, we have a round of good, bad, and ugly news, but I think we wanted to go back to some of the comments that Jamie Dimon had about the office sector first.
Yeah, so we mentioned Dimon's letter to shareholders last week, but then we got distracted and we didn't, you know, go all the way into it. So I think it's actually, you know, well worth a read, not the whole 65 pages. I mean, you could skim through some of the boring parts, but there's some really good stuff in there. Like on public policy, on America, on how America should be dealing with China and all these interesting things. So that's good. But in terms of returning to work, here are some lines from him. I'm sure a lot of you have seen these. They were big headlines. But he says, generally speaking, we envision a model that will find many employees working in location full time. Some employees may be under a hybrid model. A small percentage of employees, maybe 10%, will be working full-time from home, but for very specific roles. What I really like is when he says, and maybe that's because I'm a company man, in all these cases, the decisions will depend on what is optimal for our company and our clients, not like what's most comfortable for our employees, which is, I think, is a reasonable thing to do. He says, remote work will change how we manage our real estate. We will quickly move to a more open seating arrangement in which digital tools will help manage seating as well as needed amenities such as conference room space. Here's the kicker, right? This is the big headline that everyone was putting out there last week. As a result, for every 100 employees, we may need seats for only 60 on average. This will significantly reduce our need for real estate. So, you know, you can make that argument that each seat is going to require a little bit more space, but I don't think that, you know, a 40% drop in the number of people in the office is going to have an equivalent 40% increase in the space per employee. So definitely going to change what's going on there. They did say that, he did say that they're going to, you know, continue with the rebuild of their Midtown office building, that one that they were taking down and then rebuilding up. But there's a couple of things that I really liked what he said. He said, the virtual world has presented some serious weaknesses. He says performing jobs remotely is more successful when you know the people you're working with already. He says most professionals learn their job through an apprenticeship model, which is almost impossible to replicate in the Zoom world. Over time, this could really dramatically undermine the culture of the company. A heavy reliance on Zoom meetings actually slows down decision-making. I can 100% attest to that. And remote work virtually eliminates all spontaneous learning and creativity. This is kind of what he was talking about months back when he, what did he call it, about spontaneous combustion or something? I forget what he called it, but you don't run into people at the coffee machines. You don't talk to clients in unplanned scenarios or travel to meet customers or employees or to get feedback. So, you know, really, I think Dimon is putting his stake in the ground here and saying, you know, we're going back, but that 60 person number is definitely a little bit worrisome for the office market.
Well, not only did he put his stake in the ground, JPM also took their stake out of Lower Manhattan when they put up 700,000 square feet of space downtown up for sublet, right? So they haven't just talked the talk, they started walking the walk in terms of reducing their footprint, at least in Manhattan at this point. So I think we're gonna see a lot more of that. Martha referred to the good and the bad and the ugly that we'll talk about in the office space. Sadly, I would say there's more bad than good this week. The first I'll start off with is a piece by Wolf Street. Wolf Street is a lot like Zero Hedge. Cover financial headlines, both tilt somewhat bearish. I like it because it offsets some of the other things I read, like CNBC, analysts, research, Barron's, that tend to tilt bullish. It gives me both sides of the coin. Wolf Street summarized a report by JLL. The headline was "Office Slump Gets Ugly." And they talk about the markets in Houston, San Francisco, LA, Manhattan, Chicago, and DC. And just like Joe, I'll rattle off a couple of numbers which are not terribly comforting. In Houston, 32% of the market available for lease. That's the high watermark. In addition, there's about an $8 per square foot discount between sublet space and direct leases. So I think it's like 31 bucks per square foot for direct leases, 23 at the sublet level in Houston, which you could probably use as a proxy for many other cities, I would think, that kind of percentage. San Francisco, 24% available. LA, same thing. Manhattan, they say 17%, which sounds a little light because on a panel recently, we had a couple of guys telling us that they thought it was closer to 30% at this point when you include the kind of the whisper numbers, right? Our space is available. Downtown Chicago, I actually thought this would have been worse, 22%. DC, just over 20%. So a lot of markets with an awful lot of space available. A couple of other stories we are following. This is, again, not great. Truist offered sublet space in Orlando. So another market that's seeing more space come on board. A story that we put out is a trading alert this week, which again, highlights some of the problems that borrowers may face going forward. L Brands will not be renewing its space at 1740 Broadway in New York. That's a 600,000 square foot property in Midtown West. Blackstone, I believe, is the owner here. L Brands has almost 70% of the space, 420,000 square feet, on a lease that expires in March 2022. We learned this week when, during the remittance cycle, the loan was put on watch list and it was revealed that L Brands will not be renewing. It comes on the heels of the second largest tenant, a law firm, Davis and Gilbert, also not renewing when their lease ended late last year. They had almost 100,000 square feet, almost 16%. So unless Blackstone comes back and really fills this place up quickly, you could see 80% of this building vacant a year from now, which is staggering. And it's also not easy to find that kind of space in this market. And it's not in that part of the West Side, which has become a real magnet for the likes of Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, and others. This is kind of Midtown West, where you find accounting firms, law firms, banks, that type of thing. And this could be a challenge. The good news on the asset is that to the senior loan, a $308 million loan, there's an LTV of about 51. The property was valued at $600 million back in 2014. The loan backs a 2015 single asset deal. And if you want information on this loan, we'll make that a freebie this week. You could ping us at podcast@trep.com, and we'll share that Trepwire story with you.
So I just want to mention one more thing, and this is somewhat of a non sequitur, but I think it's related to the return to the office concept, which is that the CDC, I think it was last week, I don't know if it was the week before or last week, but they basically came out and with some studies that said it's virtually impossible to get COVID from surface transmission. So, you know, grabbing the subway rail or, you know, pressing the elevator button or exchanging the brown bag lunch with the guy delivering it to you. Some of the words coming out of this study was that contact with a contaminated surface has a less than 1 in 10,000 chance of causing infection. Lindsay Marr, an expert on airborne viruses at Virginia Tech, says, "We've known this for a long time, and yet people are still focusing so much on surface cleaning. there's really no evidence that anyone has ever gotten COVID-19 by touching a contaminated surface. So, you know, all the fears of subway ridership and Metro North and, you know, all that type of stuff, at least that part of the fear should be removed at this point. Obviously, it's still the airborne stuff you have to worry about. But, you know, this is the type of stuff that does not get any news coverage because it's not scary. So at least our many, many thousands of podcast listeners now will feel much more comfortable not wearing gloves at the grocery store.
I hate to tell you, Joe, but as somebody from my generation knows, these things have long tails. You know, my parents told me for about 20 years that the number of things that I could get from touching the sink or the bathroom or other things from a rest stop bathroom, which turned out to be true, right? It was all like urban legend, but, you know, whether it was, you know, cold sores, dandruff, athlete's foot, you know, hives, anything and everything, you know, if you turned on the sink at a rest stop in Pennsylvania, you were doomed.
Why you do the toilet flush with your foot.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, the 5 second rule.
I think we need an alternative 5 second rule, right? You have that 5 second rule where if food, you know, falls on the floor, if it's less than 5 seconds, it's still edible. You know, there's that corollary, which is if you're in a Pennsylvania rest stop, it's 1 second, but we need the alternative, which is as long as the desk has been vacated for more than 5 seconds, you're safe sitting down and, you know, working, right? You just got to wait 5 seconds before your predecessor has left. And then it's safe to, you know, use their keyboard and, you know, proceed safely at that point.
I think one of the questions that a number of these employers have is what's the process for getting back to work? And I thought it was interesting that Salesforce this week in San Francisco, one of the cities that you mentioned, Manus, with some high availability there, they're reopening their tower headquarters in May. They're doing it in stages with the first stage of workers being folks who've been vaccinated. And if I understand correctly, they'll be tested twice and they are volunteers. And stage two will be at 20 to 75% capacity, not people vaccinated. And then finally, the last stage is 100% capacity. They've got 61 floors in that tower and 1.4 million square feet of office space. So I think a lot of employers will be looking at companies like Salesforce to see how they do it.
I do have a couple of other office stories. I'll run through them very quickly. A good one was that UBS renewed its space, 138,000 square feet in Nashville. That's a Shorenstein property. You know, banks in big locations and big, you know, footprints, those are the ones you're always nervous about saying we want to downsize by 50%. So we're happy to see that. And then I have a mixed one that we wrote about, and we're also happy to share this one. This is about a CMBX 8 office loan. It was a $32 million loan, 50 Crosby Drive in Bedford, Mass. The sole tenant was an affiliate of Oracle. They gave a termination option in 2019, vacated the property. So it was 0% occupied. It paid off in full this month. So why is this a mixed bag? On the positive side, owners of the Com 2014 LC17 deal may have thought this was a loss waiting to happen since the property had been vacant. So the fact that it was paid off in full was a win. However, the lockout on the loan, which was slated to run, I believe, another 28 months or 32 months, was overridden, meaning the special servicer had given the borrower the freedom to pay off the loan without the lockout. And that meant the IO holder from that deal lost whatever it is, 28 months of income that they were counting on because this loan paid off at par. So that's the last of our good, bad, and ugly in the office space.
Turning to retail, we saw signs that the market is opening up with more properties sold.
So last month, we talked about early April being a pivotal month in the transaction space, meaning everybody had been waiting for the market to start seeing the backlog of distressed assets start to clear. And what we pointed out in late March was that there was going to be a big hotel set of sales through the auction process during the period of April 5th to April 7th. 20 hotel loans or properties were up for auction. And we thought that that was a turning point in both the market opening up and getting a sense of what fair value was. And in addition, for giving people benchmarks about what they might expect for their distressed assets on either the buy side or the sell side going forward. This month seemed to be the same type of event for the retail space. Let me run through some of the things that we've seen this week alone. In the mall space, Namdar, who has been a very active buyer of distressed assets, you know, at 10 and 20 cents on the dollar, they and Mason Asset Management took over the Country Club Mall. I believe that's near Kansas City. Cohan, which is a competitor to Namdar, they too looked to take up distressed malls and continue to run them as malls. They purchased the Lansing Mall in Lansing, Michigan for $9.2 million. That's a 700,000 square foot asset. They also purchased the Oakview Mall for $7.5 million in Southwest Omaha. So those were some big mall things we did. We expect those properties to continue to be operated as malls going forward. Gwinnett County, they purchased the aging Gwinnett Place Mall for $23 million. That's in Georgia. The interesting thing about that transaction was that the sale price was about $4 million above the most recent valuation of that property. So a little bit of a win for bondholders or mall owners in that particular case. A property in Phoenix, a shopping center there, sold for almost $10 million. So, you know, these are not great prices. A lot of the ones I rattled off were under $10 million, but it does show the marketing opening. It does show that there's a bid out there and that things are starting to clear. A few others on the list that are even more encouraging: the McKinney Marketplace in Dallas, 120,000 square foot property that's anchored by Kohl's, that was sold, not at a discount. I think they got a pretty good price. The fact that it's anchored by a non-essential entity like Kohl's, terrific. A single tenant building in Lynn, Oregon, anchored by a mom and pop store, sold for $6 million. It backed a $6 million distressed asset. So these bondholders are going to be taken out at par for something that, you know, is basically just kind of a mom and pop, you know, not really rated credit asset. And then lastly, an LA Fitness anchored retail property in Southern Florida sold for $11 million, right? Again, a type of asset that has not been really sought after, right? Gym anchored properties during COVID were really, you know, undesirable. And now all of a sudden they're catching a bid, and that's terrific. So a lot going on there. And we may look at April as the turning point for the retail segment.
I have to give a quick shout out to my local free newspaper, where they were touting the local mall's efforts to bring people in through experiential things, especially around kids. So I like the head. There was a headline in actually about the same thing on NBC New York called "Soccer Practice at the Mall? How shopping centers are adapting to post-COVID life. So instead of established brick and mortar retailers, new anchor tenants often involve health and fitness. Businesses like Pizzazzles, which I think just on the name alone, I think I want to check it out, which offer kids space to do their remote learning and dance around with bubbles after lunch. I don't know how sustainable that one is, but, or FootBK, an early development soccer facility. So, you know, I might be biased as someone with young kids, but I would do almost anything, and I would pay almost anything to kill an hour and a half of someone else running my son around inside in the winter. So I could see that. I got to go check that out. Maybe I'll do some yoga and pick up a Cinnabon on the way out.
As somebody that used to like doing 5Ks all the time, including the dead of winter, I would go for a 5K in the dead of winter in a mall. Right? You go from the Macy's to the Sears to the Dillard's.
You're explaining your future, Manus.
You know, it's flat. You know, it's pretty lengthy. By the time you go to all four corners of the mall, you've probably covered a mile, right? You have two levels. So now you're at 2 miles. And I'm at that age too, where, You know, I could, I'm no longer competing against 40-year-olds. You know, like I could fit into that happy middle right now and not get embarrassed.
You could win the division. I was actually thinking about that the other day. I'm almost old enough for the 35 and over men's basketball league, at which point I will go from being an old, decrepit, broken down basketball player to being
a star,
an absolute all-star for at least a couple of years.
You can hope. So turning to multifamily, in multifamily, we've been watching the occupancy of this sector, and we saw another concerning drop in a story that we reported in Tripwire.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, more generally. That research piece for our blog recipients, those who get our daily blog research, I think you may have seen it today, or maybe you'll see it tomorrow. You'll see it shortly. I see Haley giving me the, you know, the X sign behind the glass, but you'll see it shortly. And as we've teed it up before, it gives people a sense of which markets are doing very well, meaning occupancy is held up across their market in the apartment space, and which markets have done poorly. Those that have done poorly, we've talked about in the past. Long Island City is a disaster. Parts of Manhattan have real signs of weakness. San Francisco as well. We saw one this week that was in Washington, D.C., and it was the Drake. And the Drake backs a $44 million loan that backs a 2015 CMBS deal. What caught our attention this month was the fact that occupancy for full year 2020 was 27 points down from where it was in 2019. So it went from 96% in 2019 to 69%, under 69% in 2020. So a real sharp decline there. And it has a lot of consistencies with other types of properties that we've seen kind of hitting the wall in this big urban area, 24-hour city, often very recently built. This was built in 2014, which says to me, luxury, high price, lots of amenities, attracted younger people, recent college grads, the kind that could very easily move back home during the COVID time. And across the board, when we've seen issues, I would say a hefty percentage have fallen into this kind of property demographic. And that has been where the rubber has hit the road, and not in a good way, over the last, you know, 5-6 months of the data we've been watching.
Yeah, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal. You know, we had this big giant stimulus package pass, and you would think that you would start to see that flow through some of the numbers in our CMBS data. Now, to be fair, you know, occupancy is different than payment. You know, there's a physical occupancy and economic occupancy, but the moral of the story was that it's one thing to send New York State $2 billion in rental assistance. It's another thing to actually get that money into the right people's hands. And I'm not picking on just New York, but all states and all counties, they're just not equipped, it takes them a long time to get equipped to properly disperse these funds. So even though you see the headlines out about these stimulus, well, the stimulus checks they did a good job with, but the rental assistance and those types of things, that takes a while to actually flow through. And even then, you know, hopefully that the return to work and the return to normal will be there and ready by the time that stimulus runs out.
You know, it's a challenge for these governments, to be honest. Right. If you're too loose with this stuff, you have a lot of fraud and a lot of waste, and therefore a lot of criticism. And if you're too tight, then the money doesn't impact the economy in the way that you want it to. So, and we saw that with the stimulus. We saw a couple of states that had big issues with people submitting for multiple stimulus checks and it going to the wrong hands and so forth. So it is a challenge, and it's probably even more of a challenge when you consider that many government workers are trying to pull this off from home. So I get it.
My biggest kind of worry about this whole thing is, I mean, you know, take away the personal kind of sad aspect of this for a moment and just think about the logistical nightmare it is of thousands and thousands and tens and I don't know how many, but tons of evictions just waiting to go, right? So there's an eviction moratorium. It's been extended, but at some point, like, I don't know if you can just extend this forever, right? We talked about it weeks ago where if I'm a small landlord and I own like, you know, a quadplex or a couple of duplexes in the area, like, and I can't evict my tenants, like, how am I going to pay my property taxes? How am I going to, like, you know, so at what point do I even really own this asset anymore if I have no control over who's living in it and no control over being able to collect rent from them?
You know, I also think that there are things happening right now which could become worrisome, right? And they're twofold. One is that, you know, in New York, we saw just an extraordinarily generous budget passed last week. And we talked a little bit about this in the previous podcast, but spending was up big time. And part of that, you have to think, is because of all this stimulus money come to the state of New York, right? They said, we can afford a bigger budget, but budgets never go back down, right? They just kind of always go up. And where is the state going to find this money next time? You know, so that's, you know, one potential distortion. And then there's this desire or this need to raise taxes sharply, which always has other impacts as well. But when this thing comes to an end and people say the economy is roaring again, we know that it's not going to be evenly distributed. There's going to be winners and losers geographically, across industries and so forth. And there'll still be those that are left behind. And, you know, where are you in 2022, where the people that were supported by stimulus checks and unemployments, when these students start to burn off, you know, where's the safety net for them when eviction moratorium and unemployment ends? You know, if 40 of the 50 states are roaring and there's 10 left behind, I don't think there's going to be a lot of appetite in Congress to pass another huge stimulus. And these other 10 states will be really limping along, or at least the people that live there, you know, the waiters and waitresses and so forth. So, you know, it's a concern of mine that, you know, as we look for another roaring 20s starting in the second half of this year, that all boats don't rise equally.
I'm just looking forward to seeing you dressed up in the roaring 20s garb, Manus.
Maybe flappers and spats.
Yes.
Flappers and spats doing, what was the thing? The Charleston? Is that what people did?
Yes.
That's right.
Back in the
day? I've heard.
I'm going to start working on my Charleston. I'm going to get those shoes that, I guess, is that what a flapper was? You put over your shoes? I got to watch.
Flappers were the ladies.
The ladies. That's the name of them, I think.
What's the white thing you put over your shoes?
All I'm thinking of is the word sans culottes, which is not relevant to this discussion at all, but makes me think of those, you know, you pull the socks all the way up. You know what I mean?
I'm going to have to go back to both the Robert Redford version of The Great Gatsby and the Leonardo DiCaprio and just really inventory for myself all the things I need to know for that roaring 20s.
So turning to hotels, we had a story about a property in the gambling space.
Yeah, this is both a personal story and a, you know, one that affects our market. We did see a big purchase this week. Bally's has sold the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas. So I think the sale price there was $150 million. The buyer was Black Hawk and Rock Island Gaming. And this is, you know, of a piece of everything we've been talking about in this podcast, that, you know, travel destinations 6 months ago were the kind of thing that people weren't sure how to value these things. Like, when are we coming back? What's the strength of the recovery? And now that we're seeing how many people are getting vaccinated, I think we're just on the precipice of just an explosive rebound. And to this point, every year until last year, or most years until this year, I would do a Las Vegas trip with some buddies, fellows I had grown up with in Stony Brook, New York. And we would go to Vegas for 4 days and watch football, college football on Saturday, pro football on Sunday, have a couple of porterhouses, and you know, just really get back together. So a buddy of mine who comes in from Omaha last year said his trip, his flight from Omaha to Las Vegas that he booked for September was $1,000. So we are back. When it comes to airfares, I looked at my own. It was going to be, I think, $500 to go from LaGuardia or Charlotte, depending on where I am, to Las Vegas. And it was like $600, which is, you know, pre-pandemic pricing. And we're back, right? If that's the price you're getting right now, right, demand is already there.
We're back, baby. We are so back.
I mean, and I happen to love this trip. It is just, you're 20 all over again in a good way, right? And because you're out on the West Coast, it's football starting at 9 a.m., right? You're watching it and it's still going on until 10 o'clock at night, right? It's porterhouses, it's ribeyes. You know, when you come back, you feel like you have to have a stent put in, but you know, in between it's golf and it's, you know, maybe some live action stuff if there's a boxing thing going on. It's just a great way to spend a weekend.
I got the call for a guy's golf trip like a month ago. I floated it and I got that sideways glance, like almost out the back of your head. You know,
you got the Heisman.
I got the,
we have two crazy small children.
I got the,
of course,
you crazy?
That look. You're going to get that look.
We're ready, man. We got to tee up Joel down in Georgia and,
that's right.
And get that going.
I'll drive down overnight, play around the golf and drive home. I'll be home in time for bedtime. Books in bed. Toy Story books in bed.
There we go.
And so deal of the week, Joe, this one's yours this week.
Yeah. So actually we had a loyal listener send us their deal of the week. It's actually Mark Schussler from Newmark. It's kind of a good deal of the week because it brings together some stuff that's going on in the market, but also some of our own data. So it's not necessarily the type of deal that Manus likes to do, which is like retail property selling or something like that. But this is a $48 million non-performing loan sale just closed. And speaking of Vegas, actually, our segues this week are on point, I have to say. It's the Bank of America Plaza at 300 South 4th Street in Vegas. It's two buildings, 17 stories, about 275,000 square feet. It's currently about 52% occupied. Mark could not disclose the price, but a couple of things that we should point out. The buyer was a joint venture between Barker Pacific Group and Positive Investments, both out of Los Angeles. Steven Schultz, Tony Gorgiev, no relation to the Rangers backup goalie, I think, with Newmark's national loan sales team represented the seller. Mark Schussler, Mike Tabeek, Sean Fulp, and Ryan Plummer with Newmark's private capital group represented the buyer. So what's interesting to me, and that's kind of the extent of what we can see from Mark and from the press release here of the deal, but this particular property had been in two CRE CLOs over the last several years, the most recent one being a Marathon Asset Management CRE CLO. We have a lot of data on it. I won't go into it, but this was kind of one of those bridge to bridge situations. It looks like, you know, about half occupied. They had some business plans in place. And I think we know who the original owner was based on our data. I don't want to call them out really, but it's always very interesting when you see these deals happen on loans that were in CMBS or series CLOs, because you can really dive into the details to see what happened there. So one other thing that Mark had mentioned was that the buyers plan to take over the property and lease it up, and their new lower basis will allow them to offer tenants some competitive lease rates and incentives. So, you know, this is the point of deal of the week, right? Is people who are listeners get to shout out the great work that they're doing. So thanks again for that, Mark.
And let me throw something else out there that I've been meaning to mention. Next month, we'll be putting out, or I guess it's been about a month and a half, we'll be putting out our semi-annual magazine about the CRE market. It comes through our sister company, Commercial Real Estate Direct. If you are looking to put together a thought leadership piece, we do take submissions for those that really want to have something which is thought leaderly, not a kind of shameless plug, which I'm known for doing periodically for our own business. So it's not looking for a shameless plug for your business, but something that's kind of research oriented. We're looking for that. And if anybody would like to advertise, here comes our shameless plug in our magazine, which goes to, I think, about 20,000 people every year, real estate CRE professionals. Please reach out to Haley and she will set you up.
Podcast, trep.com. So now on to the shout outs. We had Chris T shared our content on Twitter. Ben Moss tweeted Trep Data and he said he had to go back to the podcast and listen to some of the numbers we quoted last week because he thought it was surprising. Will S., Ginger R., who's been a regular listener since last summer and appreciates the relaxed and plain English approach to what's going on in the market. So good job, you guys, for speaking plain English.
It's not the first time Manus has been called plain. Just saying.
Ouch.
Well, you know what? You know, there's that expression, he's a man of few words. I like to say I'm a man of little words. You know, like to, it, the, the.
Small words.
Was, you know, you get into three syllables and I'm really beyond my, I'm really out of my lane, so to speak.
David D. Followed up to some of the comments he made to us last week, which was, I think, helpful. And Donut Shorts, who's a regular retweeter of some of our content, he posted some of our bank content on bank loan performance data, which is a report that we put out this week. So if you're interested in that, give us a shout. Dan McNamara, who's been a guest and a frequent shout-outer, I guess, if that's a word. He says that the podcast is one of the best that he listens to about the CMBS CRE space. So thanks for saying that. And Steel City Dave loved the segment last week covering the CRE CLOs. And he had an observation after traveling recently. He said there were no available rental cars or Ubers. So if you're planning to travel, Manus, you may want to think about getting a driver.
I'm a driver myself. I'm not much of an Uber guy and I'm not much of a rent-a-car guy. You know, I like driving myself to and from. You know, I like putting on, as people know from my past rantings, some classic rock, you know, a concert from the 60s or 70s that may take up, you know, 2.5 hours of my time and kill a good part of a long ride. That's kind of my vibe.
Manus is probably the smartest person I know, maybe top two. And I still think it would be a viral, hilarious YouTube video just watching him try to order an Uber. There's no way. There's just no way it's happening.
By the way, are you number two in that top two? I was just curious.
Me? No.
Joe is damning me with faint praise because he only knows about seven people.
Probably true. Well, guys, perhaps you talk about car shortage. One of the best indicators that things are turning back to normal is what I'm going to call the toilet paper index. Sales of bath tissue have dropped back to pre-pandemic levels.
Are people eating less?
No.
I hope that's from people having stockpiled and nothing more. I hope it's not a behavioral issue.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. So stop hoarding. You don't need to anymore. With that, we'll close. Thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Join us next week as we review what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or a comment, send us an email to podcast@trep.com. For more info, visit trep.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.